Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 3rd, 2016, and welcome to episode 117 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. Happy New Year! I'm your host, Michael Mulhern, and with me, I have Jack Nutting. How are you this morning, Jack?
Oh, I'm just fine, although I think you'll find it's not morning.
I'm looking out my window here, and it looks like morning to me. love this round planet thing with only one sun in the sky. We'll have to do something about that. Let's all move to a binary system. And, Ken, how are you this morning?
I'm fine this afternoon, Michael. Happy New Year to you.
And lurking somewhere north of the U.S. border in Canada is Paul. How are you, Paul? And what time of the year is it in Montreal?
It is the January time of year up here in Montreal.
Ah.
And covered in snow. So, there we go.
Snow. That's a severe absence of that where I am.
You can have, we have
the
plenty.
The closest I've got is it's currently a slow drizzle of rain. Well, could you put it in a post pack and send some down to me? It'd be greatly appreciated, but make sure it's well insulated. I don't need a baggie of water.
Yeah, but if just yesterday any indication, Michael, you'll get it in time for your winter.
Probably will. Okay. Well, here we are. It's 2016, and we're making all our plans for what we'll be doing with our computers in the forthcoming year. So, my question to my friends here is, would you make an irreversible upgrade or mod to one of your retro computers? That is anything from simply adding a 3.5mm audio jack so that you can retro game into the wee hours of the morning without waking up the rest of the household. Or would you cut a hole or slot in the case to feed some other cable through? Or would it be working on the motherboard, cutting a trace or adding a jumper or any other change, though the effect could be reversed but not the original condition? So, gentlemen, how far would you go upgrading a retro machine? Jack, what are your thoughts on this?
I don't think I would have a problem with, like, cutting apart cases or making changes that were reversible, but would still not be back to the original condition. As long as I knew that I had a pretty good feeling that it was going to actually work. Like the last time I tried to do something along these lines, I had a Sega Game Gear handheld game thing, and the screen was starting to go all sort of like, it was just very sort of weird amounts of contrast and color. You could hardly see anything. And I read a line and someone said, well, it's because of the bad capacitors that were a big problem in the late 80s, early 90s. And if you just replace all the capacitors on the device, it might just be fine. And I was like, okay, that sounds cool. I can do that. I can like see what the capacitors are and order some new ones, and I can solder stuff and I can do this. And I did all that, and I changed all the capacitors on the thing because some of them were obviously leaky and terrible. And I put it all back together and turned it on, and it was exactly the same. Like, it didn't break anything. It didn't make any worse, but it didn't even fix anything. And I felt like I spent, like, hours and hours researching this and many more hours doing the soldering, and it's like, damn.
So you irreversibly maintained the flaw. Excellent.
Yeah. So that's my only concern is that like I would get into a project that I was actually not capable of doing properly.
Well, it looks like you had the right solution, but to the wrong problem.
Yeah, probably so.
So basically, you wouldn't have any qualms with cutting into a retro machine. Of course, we're not talking about all our Apple Ones that are in the glass cabinet in the living room. We're just talking about our good old common garden variety Commodore 64s or Apple IIs or Tandys.
Sure. So, yeah, like I had, back in the day, I had an Atari 400 that I had, like, I'd expanded to 64K of RAM through some weird thing that required some soldering and trace cutting and stuff, which I got some help to do. And that was fine, and it worked great, and I had no problem doing that. And I would happily do the same thing again today. Because, like you said, it's not an Apple One. There's no monetary value in keeping the thing mint or anything. So as long as I felt like I could accomplish it, I would have no problem doing
that. That's right. I agree with you. If I feel that it's within my capabilities of my soldering skills or whatever, that I go for it. Because I would have done it back then anyway to make that upgrade. Like you said, adding up to the 64K of RAM. It's something that we would have done, especially if it would have saved us a whole lot of the folding stuff. So, Ken, what are your thoughts on modding our retro machines?
Very similar to Jack's, where if I thought I could do it correctly, or even better, if I could give it to a professional to do, I would go for it. For example, I once hired somebody to upgrade my Zip GS accelerator, and he did, but it took him 2 years to do it, during which time I had a very slow Apple II. But at least he knew what he was doing, and when I got it back, it did work. That's not something I could ever do. I can just think of all the times when, as a little kid, I had something that I didn't realize how irreplaceable it was, and I thought, oh, it'd be so much cooler if I just changed it like this, and then I broke it or ruined it, and I had to wait 20 years and go on eBay to buy a replacement.
Yeah, or you put it back together and it works, and you're going, but where do these bits go?
So, like, for example, I replaced the connector on my 8-bit NES, and now it works much better than it ever used to. And that was a fairly simple modification. It was literally just unscrewing it, taking one part out, and putting one part in. It wasn't irreversible, per se. So if I had to, like, drill a hole in my Apple II, if it was that easy, just drilling a hole, I probably would, even though it was irreversible, because I'm not a collector, and Apple IIs are meant to be used. So, depending on the scale and difficulty of the mod, yes, I would make that change.
Yeah, I'm sort of that way a bit as well. But let's hear from Paul first. Paul, what are your thoughts on taking the hacksaw or the Dremel to one of your retro machines?
Yeah, well, okay, so it seems like there are a couple of different things that are interacting here. So one issue, like this thing with the capacitors, that is something that I think I would probably do just because it's toxic. You know, it could harm the thing if they stay there. You know, even if the capacitor hasn't leaked yet, it will, at least in a certain era of particularly Apple and Next boards. So, and same with batteries. You know, it seems like the original condition is not going to be maintained. If you leave the things in there, it'll corrode if you take them out. It's not original. But I would have no problem replacing the capacitors in principle, and I have many of them that I would like to do, although I'm a little nervous about it. But the other thing is the things like the Apple One, the one thing that's kind of tricky about those is that they were specifically designed to make these modifications on. I mean, they have a big, huge breadboard part where you're supposed to be doing little experiments and things like that, so it's a little bit sad that those ones that are specifically designed to do that with you no longer can do. But again, I probably couldn't bring myself to do it. It's an Apple III prototyping board, you know, so it was something that Apple sent out to people who were going to build peripheral cards and things for the Apple III. And there's no way I'm going to actually, like, use this to create a peripheral card, even though it is a breadboard. It's specifically designed to do that. But, you know, the historical value of just seeing what it was when it was originally sent out and sold is you know, more important, I think, for something like that. But otherwise, I think for something like, you know, putting the audio jack in an Apple IIc, I would have, or 2GS, I think I would have no problem with that. I think I get a little bit more hesitant as the years get closer to 1977, but for Apple stuff. particularly, I guess, basically things that I might be doing this to the last one I'll ever see. I think I would be much more gun shy with that. But otherwise, the things that I would have done back in the day with such a thing, I wouldn't normally have a problem with, I think. So I don't know. Many random thoughts.
Mm. No, well, yeah, I myself wouldn't have any issues with getting in and making a hole or a slot in a case just to run something through. Now, there are plenty of spots that it can be done where it's not immediately obvious, and you can get it done. But as I said, we would have upgraded these machines. Dare I say, common garden variety retro machines. We would have modded them to get more out of them back in the day, and I'd still do that. Strangely enough, the one thing I wouldn't do to my favorite retro machine, which in my case is the Apple IIc, is actually retrobride it. Kind of decided a while ago that it's going to gracefully go beige in different ways, and the space bar's gone a different color from the rest of the keyboard. The switches are still the brilliant platinum white compared to the case, which is now a lovely sort of chocolate cream color or coffee cream color. But it's just something I don't want to do because I don't want to possibly damage any of the screen printing that's on it. But anything else, I think, for my machines is pretty much fair game. It's just interesting. I agree with you that the closer things get back to that 70s position in the timeline, the more reticent I am about making a change like that. But more modern machines, or even back into about 20-year-old machines, I'll pull them apart, put them together, change bits and pieces in them, move them around the family and friends group. But the older the machine gets, the little bit more reticent I am about making those changes. But I'm all for it myself, and if our gentle listeners are not wanting to take the chainsaw and just like trim an extra slot in the back of their machine, there are plenty of non-destructive or non-invasive upgrades that are out there for all of our machines, so I think everyone's going to be happy with upgrading the machines in some manner. Okay, well, got some interesting listener feedback since our last show. One from Tony, showing us a link to a range of new build RPN calculators modeled on the classic HPs. That's over at swissmicros.com. So if anyone remembers or even still has their HP calculators, here is a way to get a modern build of those different types of calculators. And as they say in their pages, they don't maintain all the bugs that are in the originals. So these are all new, bug-free, but styled on that lovely wood grain and metal finish for the HP calculators. So guys, any of you still using your HP RPN calculators? Or are you just using your apps on your phones?
It's all apps.
The last standalone calculator I used was a TI-82 or 83 in high school, or actually college, and I have not had to have a standalone calculator since then.
Yeah, I must admit I've moved pretty much solely to the various apps on whatever phone I've got. It's quite handy just to have the different types there if I need to do various calculations or if I'm mucking around with some mainframe output and EPSIDEC, looking at it in hex and wanting to change things to ASCII. But
Well, do you remember that gentleman who took a Radio Shack flyer from like the early 80s and demonstrated that every product on a single page had all been replaced by just one smartphone?
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that, but yes, it's quite possible. The ever-decreasing amount of clutter on our desks from back in the day is now on one simple little Android or phone or iPhone. Hmm. Okay, now, another one we got is from Mark, advising us that the Retro Challenge is back with the winter warm-up for 2016. So we'll include the link to that. There's already quite an impressive list of contestants, let's say, or entries into the winter warm-up. So if any of our listeners there have got the urge to do, as they say, anything retro, have a thought about documenting it over the month of January. You know, get a blog going and document what you're doing, be it a software, programming, hardware, mod, upgrade, or trying to use a retro machine as your main daily machine for the month, and then maintaining a diary or something along those lines. Anything that you can loosely link to being a retro challenge is eligible to go in, and that the link will have information on what you need to do.
Yeah, there are actually quite a lot of entries on the Retro Challenge site already. I mean, I think it's underway in principle, although I keep thinking I'm gonna send a late entry myself. But yeah, I didn't even count them. But there's like, I don't know, 25 or something. They all look really quite interesting.
Yeah, I lost count scrolling through. Yeah, I'm torn between going in and putting a new project in there, and sort of like knowing that there's very little that I can do in just a month. It takes me ages to get through any of my projects. But if anyone out there can actually think they can do something in 30 days, or 27 in this case, because it's a all January competition, by all means, get going and do something. But I think I might give this one a miss this time round.
But I think I will definitely follow along and sort of see what people are doing. There's someone's looking to make a low-res graphics library for the Apple II, and someone else is porting Star Trek to the Aquarius. And so Michael Sternberg is the one who's doing the Aquarius one. Vintage Volt says, my retro challenge is to live my life as a teenager again. So presumably that'll be looking at racy 8-bit graphics. But yeah, no, it's I envy these people the time they are going to spend here. But I am still sort of hoping I can think of something and spend a week. We'll see.
It would be good. It would be good. Okay, so moving on into our what's new out there, Jack. What's happening with all the VCF East?
Well, some new videos are posted. A bunch of VCF East videos from VCF East 5, 6, and 9.1 are posted. And someone believes that our good friend Kevin Savitz is the one who did some post-processing to make these things be done. If so, good job, Kevin. If not, whoever did, good job. There's a bunch of stuff here. There are a couple dozen-ish videos, and I haven't looked at them all, but it's surely all good fun stuff from VCF East.
Well, and I think, you know, it's a place not that many people actually managed to get to it. But they've had really sort of impressive speakers and talks and things. So I'm really quite looking forward to digging through those. I am embarrassed to say I have not been to a single one, even though I am sort of in the vicinity. But maybe next one.
I would not be surprised if it is Kevin Savitz doing the editing, because I know he recently helped the Kansas Fest committee get entire year's worth of videos posted that had never been seen before. So kudos to him for chipping in and volunteering his time and energy.
Yes, yep. Thanks.
Yeah, sort of sorting all through the videos and getting them prepared and up is quite a lot of work and effort involved. I do a little bit of video editing for family sorts of bits and pieces here. And again, it's one of those things, just trying to find the time, get them all sorted out. Normally there's a lot of cleaning up to be done on some of them. And yeah, so if it's Kevin's work, that's a big thank you. Big thank you.
And assuming that this is all Kevin doing all this stuff, and we talked that we don't have time, so where does he get all of the time to do this? I think somehow he may be siphoning off some of our free time.
I think he's gone and stolen some of my free time.
Well, if you read his memoir, Terrible Nerd, you'll learn about how he realized that he was in an industry where he had to trade his time for money, like most of us do, and he decided to innovate and create a life where that was not necessary. And so that gives him the freedom to pursue his passions, which I wish more of us had the courage and intelligence to do.
Interesting. I have his book, but I haven't gotten that far. I need to pick it up again. I haven't had time.
You haven't gotten the part where he says, I'm brave and smart, and you should be too.
It's right under the Getting Things Done book, right?
That's right.
7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Mm. What did you say, the Kevin Savitz of Highly Effective People?
Something like that.
Close enough.
Well, he's a very highly effective person. Okay. Well, moving on. Ken, Retro VGS is now a Coleco console. So this is an update to what's been happening?
Well, you basically just said everything I had to say. Thank you, Michael. The Retro VGS, or video game system, which we spoke about back in September when they were doing an Indiegogo campaign, is back. The Indiegogo campaign was an abject failure, with only about 1% of its total funding being achieved. I think at one point it actually got as high as 2 or even 4, but people then withdrew their funding because Indiegogo, I believe the kind of campaign they were running is that you get all the money whether or not you meet your goal, and people realize they're not going to meet their goal, so we don't want to give them money. So the Retro VGS is a new video game system, and it is cartridge-based, not CD, DVD, USB, or even internet. It is a completely offline console because the creators, who I believe is the editor-in-chief of Retro Magazine, believe that that was the golden age of home consoles, when games shipped when they were done and didn't need patches or DLC or in-app purchases afterward. And I guess a lot of people didn't necessarily agree with him due to the lack of funding, so he has pursued funding elsewhere and has found it with the company that is currently known as Coleco. It is a sort of a rebranding or refounding of course, the Connecticut Leather Company that is most famous for the ColecoVision game console and the Cabbage Patch Kids. And that company went bankrupt ages ago, so there is a new company who has bought the rights to the name and is now partnering with the creators of Retro VGS to rebrand the console as a new Coleco system. It's basically the exact same system that was seeking funding previously. Nothing has changed. It just has a new name and a new partner and new backers. So there you go.
Oh, it still sounds good. I agree. I like the idea of it all being cartridge-based.
Well, I mean, there are pros and cons to that. I mean, I agree that when we had cartridge games, that was the golden age of many different kinds of games, especially because for many of us, it was our childhood. But I think that being cartridge-based will limit those who have access to make games for this system, because that requires a lot more capital than just putting a game up on Humble or Itch.io. And not everybody has that kind of startup, you know. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing so much innovation in gaming now and access to game development by so many is because the barrier has gone down so much. And so this console that is being created will reinstitute some of those barriers, and I don't necessarily know who's going to benefit from that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I think a lot of the problem that we saw before when we were talking about this was the price. I mean, like it was just the price was so expensive that it wouldn't really be worth it for the kind of thing that you were getting. And I think this is sort of the same kind of, it's not entirely the same thing, but it's, you know, if cartridges are themselves going to be expensive, then that does wind up being making this of somewhat limited use. I wonder if maybe the cartridges, you know, like maybe there are cartridges you can download things onto or something. I am curious to know what the actual details are about this. And apparently there is going to be a demo. It's being shown at the Toy Fair in New York, in February.
Oh, interesting. It probably won't be at CES, which I think this is this week, though.
Yeah, and no, I think the first is for, as I understand it, the first demo is mid-February.
Okay. So I'm sure we've not heard the last of this. It'll be interesting, and maybe we'll even have somebody on the show in a future episode to talk more about it.
Hmm.
Another work in progress. Okay, well, next one I've got here is sort of in line with the host topic, is doing upgrades to your machine. So in this case here, there's a new or revisited putting a vampire in your Atari 600. So for about €150, that's about $165 US, you can get a upgrade for your Amiga 600 and pop it in and make it one mean, fast little beast. Now, this pages that we'll link here basically show it as a work in progress and that they're taking pre-orders, so perhaps it'll be ready for general consumption pretty soon. But just checking out the specs here, I'm quite impressed with what they're fitting into this system to add into the Amiga 600. Is anyone familiar with the amount of space that's inside the case? I'm sort of interested in sort of like how tight a fit this is to get it in there. Is it going to be like a difficult exercise in sort of like getting it fitted?
I can't say for sure. I had an Amiga 500 that I remember opening up, and like that was pretty roomy already. It was not like jam packed in there by any stretch.
Okay.
I think the 600 is about the same size externally, and probably has a smaller motherboard and smaller components overall because it's newer. So it's probably not that hard to fit some stuff in there. But I agree with you that it's an impressive amount of things in a single upgrade.
Yeah, it's like RAM upgrade, video upgrade, SD card for hard drive storage. It says 64-bit core, 32-bit compatibility.
HDMI out.
Oh,
I know. A lot of stuff in one thing. So.
And yeah, that's
nice.
One vicious little vampire.
But it continues to make use of the original board. So it somehow drives the original board as well. It's not just entirely replacing it, I think.
Right.
Is that right?
I believe
Yeah, this looks like it's it clips over the existing CPU. Let's see here. Remove the motherboard, lower heat shield. Okay, so it's even using the existing mounting points. So it's saying it's no drilling required. Once the screws are in, you'll never need to remove the lower shield again. So this is pretty much heading in the way of the ultimate non-destructive upgrade to your machine.
I like it. That's cool. Mm. Can you turn it off?
Yeah, I'm just that's an interesting thought actually. To can you go back to your switch selectable to go back to just being a boring old nice Amiga 600?
Well, like every time you sort of feel like, I don't know, was this worth it? You can turn it off and say, yes, this was worth it.
Oh, just have to get a spare machine and just use the two. But this definitely for €150, this is, you're definitely getting value for money for that. Obviously, there's probably going to be shipping involved on top of that, but that is very impressive specifications for. Really, quite an affordable price. I won't say it's cheap. $160 of anyone's dollars is quite a lot, but I'm sure we've all managed to splash that kind of money on other products and bits and pieces that are out there.
Yep.
So, Paul, I'll let you take the next one.
Yeah. So this again sort of fits in a little bit, at least partially, with the the host topic of making modifications. What this is a video basically describing how to take MAME and add it to a vector monitor output. But if you have, so what they've done is if you have an oscilloscope with a XY control, or they've done this also with a Vectrex, which is how it connects to the what would you modify topic. You can use MAME as the brain and the vector display as the output to get something like a realistic asteroids. So one of the examples of this was someone took an actual, I think, asteroids board and stuck it in a Vectrex. So it's like a little mini asteroids cabinet. But so apparently this is Trammell Hudson and Adele Lynn, and I'm not sure where this talk was. It's a talk from a conference of some sort, and they talk about basically they have a little, I think it's a teensy microcontroller attached to a little board with a couple of sort of like translation chips of some kind, and This is basically what you need to interface to an oscilloscope monitor for an actual vector output from MAME games like Asteroids and things. So it seems pretty cool. I don't think I'd want to do this to a Vectrex. I think I would much rather do this to some anonymous oscilloscope. But that I very much like that idea. So I don't know. I haven't watched the entire video, I have to admit, but there is a 20-minute video or something where they sort of talk about the process of putting it together, and they show the board and they show some examples of what they're doing. So worth a look.
I think it is. I haven't played a good vector Asteroids game in a long time. Just not quite the same without the old vector screens. So, Ken, our friends at Digital Antiquarian have got something for us.
That is true, and the Digital Antiquarian is the name of the blog run by Mr. Jimmy Mayer, who had the honor of interviewing for Open Apple episode number 24, way back in February of 2013. The Digital Antiquarian is a blog reviewing the history, or chronicling the history, of computer entertainment software, basically, looking at specific publishers, developers, franchises, and brands. And it is exhaustive. Jimmy posts about, I think it's one blog post a week, or maybe even two. And full disclosure, I am one of his Patreon backers. And these chronicles that he produces are exhaustive. They are almost mini novellas, each individual issue or episode or blog post. And he produces them almost faster than you can read them, because usually you don't want to sit in your Chrome or Firefox browser for an hour and read all this fascinating history. You want to like download it to Instapaper or bookmark it for later or something, and then by the time you remember to get back to it, there's more. And it's kind of like YouTube, where for every minute you spend watching YouTube content, 72 more hours is uploaded. You just can't keep up. And Jimmy Mayer is like the YouTube of video game history. So somebody, one of his readers, with his permission, took those writings of his and put them into EPUB format. You can download them in EPUB or in Kindle format, and they are broken down into annual volumes. There's one volume for 1966 through 1979, and then it goes annual from there, 1980, 81, 82, all the way up to 86. You can download them, as I said, in EPUB or Kindle, and you can download them with or without comments, which his WordPress blog supports, and he feels that the reader interactions with his history is part of the experience, so he gives you the opportunity to download the comments as well. These are completely free, which means he's not selling his own readers' comments, which is pretty cool. And I think this is great, because I have fallen well behind on this fascinating work. Obviously, I think it's worthwhile if I'm giving him money for it every month on Patreon. And I just haven't had the time or environment in which to consume this content that I'm paying for. And now it's available in EPUB and Kindle, and I'm going to grab that and throw it on my iPad mini and read it at my leisure. So thank you to Richard Lindner, who created these formats for just everybody to enjoy. Does anybody else here read this blog?
Intermittently, but I think this is, as you said, is a great way of catching up with what's already been out there. And you know, I find it at times a lot more convenient to read something in a semi-offline or offline in an ebook reader, iPad or tablet, depending on where I am and which device I take. But I think I could really enjoy downloading and reading these. It's just, as you said, it's a great distillation of his excellent writing, and I agree. The reader comments a lot of the time are almost as good as his original blog, which gets that commentary going.
Right.
Yeah, I think I too have been super impressed. I'm sure we've a couple of times linked to things, you know, individual articles that he's written and posted, but sometimes, you know, the original authors and things will, of the interactive fiction game he's looking at the time, will be in the comments and he will reply to them. And, you know, so I think it is a great resource, and he's doing real sort of like historian work. I mean, you know, it's quite professional. So I will definitely be checking this out for those times when I am not online.
Yeah, one thing I'll mention is that About 2 years ago, this month actually, Juice GS interviewed Al Lowe of Leisure Suit Larry, which was a fascinating piece that became our cover story, and I shared with Jimmy the unedited audio from that interview. It was not ever published anywhere, but I knew that there was probably stuff in there that I, as an editor, didn't feel was necessary or possible to include in Juice GS, but which might nonetheless be of historical value. And then Jimmy used that in an article he wrote about 6 months ago and cited Juice GS. And I really appreciate that he found something of value in there, that he cites his sources. This guy is exhaustive, and he will leave no stone unturned. And it was an honor for me to contribute to the library of information available to him to use in his research.
Just to mention, too, I think he... this is another thing that I have yet to read, but he wrote a book some time ago about the Amiga. That was one of the sort of like main things that he's published in the, you know, in the retro computing world. I think it's called The Future Was Here.
Yes, and that was published by MIT Press right in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Ah, excellent.
I thought there was another book he wrote. If he did, it wasn't by MIT Press. I could be just making stuff up. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, that is correct. The Future Was Here, about the Commodore Amiga. And it's in hardcover and Kindle. Yay.
Okay. Well, again, continuing on our hardware upgrade theme, we have a blog here from Terry Stewart, Tezza, adding composite video to a Sinclair ZX81. Now, this is, in this case here... Terry has gone and removed the RF out and replaced it with a composite video, meaning that he didn't have to put any extra holes in the cases, was able to use that space. But it was basically a mod driven by the need to replace a display. He's in his blog, starts off with a picture of his ZX81 connected via the RF out to a TV, which was the way that you did it back then. And that TV is no longer available for him to use. And he was aware of a modification to add composite video and did some quick Googling, found the schematic, decided it was within his skill set, and then proceeded to do the mod. So again, it's an excellent... series of pictures with text explaining in detail of what needs to be done, how to approach it, problems that you could encounter along the way, especially one with a very fragile keyboard ribbon that connects the board and the keyboard, how to get around that breakage problem. And his photography is excellent. I myself am not one for taking good photos. I just think it's an innate lack of composition and unsteady hand. Even with a decent digital camera, I just still can't take decent photos. But in here, he takes us through connecting it up, testing it, and then the final product showing it there, and it is quite good. So here we are. This is a mod driven by the necessity of having a different type of monitor to do the display, and I think his work has turned out quite well.
Yeah, this seems like I'm pretty sure that I have a Timex Sinclair that someone already did this to, but... So for something like this, I think the same would be true of the Atari 2600. I think would be like this as well, right? That it has. So my understanding, at least, of what happens inside these things is that there is a composite signal that goes into an RF converter box of the familiar sort, and then that is the thing that puts it on channel 3 or 4 or 2 or whatever. So I would hope. I haven't read through this very carefully, but I would hope that this is almost a matter of primarily just bypassing the RF converter.
Seems reasonable to think so.
Mm.
That's what I would assume.
But I do like the fact that one of the points of this, as I'm skimming through it, I think, is to actually use the same jack, you know, so that's the same output, the same port, rather than have another little thing dangling out.
Yeah, being a small machine like that, there's already enough cables hanging out of it just to get it operational. No, it's quite a nice mod, and as I said, it's well documented, good clear photography, excellent commentary, and if anyone was ever thinking of doing this to their ZX81 or Sinclair, Atomic Sinclair 1000, this should give you some inspiration to get in there and make that mod. So, Paul, you've got something on a web browser. Does anyone still use web browsers?
Well, yeah. So I came across this I don't know, like a week ago or something. And I'm not sure. So I don't really know the context that it's in. There's a site called oldweb.today, and from what I understand, basically what it allows you to do is, first of all, emulate web browsers, you know, various different sorts, going back to like Mosaic generally, is, you know, at least the prior to the thing I'm about to talk about. And then I think it also will browse snapshots of different times in the past as well. So, you know, it'll look at basically like the Wayback Machine. So you can use the old web browser on the old web, which I think is pretty cool. The thing that was, you know, just sort of recently publicized was that they've added to this basically the original web browser by Tim Berners-Lee. It's basically, it'll emulate Nextstep, I think Nextstep 1. I'm not so sure about that because the cube is in color. But at least the browser is called the Hypermedia Browser Editor version 1 alpha something, right? I mean, like, this is like the pretty much the original web browser, and you can actually try it out, use it in your browser. I tried it a couple times, and it's basically a Nextstep emulator as well, so if you want to try out Nextstep, there's also another place you can do it. I found the cursor control actually quite not very easy, at least when I was trying it today. I don't remember having that problem before, but still, you know, it runs respectably fast, and it's neat to actually see the thing. So if you want to check that out, have a look. I wish I knew more about the history of this, you know, like where the code came from and that sort of thing. I will definitely explore Old Web today a little bit further in the future as well, even apart from the original Next browser.
Yeah, this is actually really cool. I had never seen this Old Web today site before, but actually when you posted this link, and when I clicked on it, it sort of brought back all these memories because you see Nextstep booting up and all these things, which is pretty cool, which I haven't seen in a long time. I remember this first web browser. Paul, you might remember. So back in the day, we went to college together, and this professor, Roger Kirchner, who unfortunately passed away in the past year, he was a huge proponent of everything new, and he loved the Next and all these things. And I remember him showing me this app. He's like, "Look at this World Wide Web app. It's hypermedia, and it's you can link to documents." And I was like, "Yeah, well, that doesn't look like much of anything." I did not think this was going to be a thing at all. But I remember it looked just like it looks in the emulator here. It's just like, you know, it kind of looks like a text document with some underlined stuff in it, and you can click on it and kind of click around. But it was very sort of a very primitive web browser compared to what we have now. But it was definitely the germ of the idea was fully visible right there. And I thought it was not a thing.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I was in high school when the web started being a thing, and we had a computer lab with Mosaic installed, and I thought I'd already been on the internet for years because I had email and Telnet and all this other stuff, and then all these kids started talking about, "Oh, look at this World Wide Web," and I'm like, "Yeah, that's part of the internet. I've been on that for years. Big deal." But little did I know. Also, Jack, there was something that you just shared with us which I think may have been overlooked, but which is very important, and which I'm not sure I understood because I never knew it before. You and Paul went to college together?
It's true. We did.
Yep.
Really? I had no idea. Huh.
Way back when. That's how we knew each other, and that's how I kind of came into this, what was it, a year and more ago? Was because I was talking to Paul, and he said, "Hey." Well, actually, I'd been emailing all of you guys with complaints about your lacking Atari coverage. And then Paul reached out and said, "Hey, why don't you join us? So, yeah, so Paul and I went to college together.
Was that undergrad?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was at,
wow. That's so cool. Do you have, like, photos with you together that you can share on Throwback Thursday?
Not much. There are a couple. So we were actually in a band together, and there are a couple of photos
it's
of
getting
this
better.
Band.
What did you each play?
We both played guitar and sang.
That is so cool. It wasn't like chiptune. It was a rock band.
It was a rock band.
Well, I guess rock band back then would be chiptune now because your instruments are so old. So,
yes.
Are there recordings or albums?
There are not albums, but there are definitely recordings.
And how would I find these recordings?
Now, wait a minute.
This is retro. Come on.
We got the domain actually not too long ago, right?
We had the domain. So the band's
We were watching for a long time and finally jumped on it.
Yeah, so the band's name is Scape Dog.
Scape Dog.
And scapedog.com will lead you to a marvelous website.
Like, is there going to be a reunion tour? Is that why you have the domain?
There should be.
Oh my gosh.
Putting the band back together.
Yes.
I'm so glad I'm in on this episode. This is amazing.
And in fact, so scapedog.com actually contains a couple of photos near the top, which have Paul and I standing beside each other. That's pretty much...
Oh my God, go in there right now. Scapedog.com.
Yes. Yeah, I was just to back up a little bit to talking about the Roger Kirshner and the World Wide Web. He at the same time, basically my experience in that Next Lab, my experience with the Next basically was from being in that Next Lab when he hired me to basically provide access through a Gopher server. You know, I was basically developing the Gopher and the Carlton node on the Gopher Gopher network. He was very into all of these very new technologies. Yet another thing that's getting us way off topic and a good start for 2016. But Roger Kirshner also taught my parents mathematics, and my father cites him as the reason that he no longer pursued mathematics. My mother, though, went on to major in it, but at any rate.
Yeah,
wow, small world.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I'm with your father on that one. As much as I enjoyed mathematics, I just encountered one teacher that basically did it in for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, the rabbit holes we dive down here. So yeah. Let us know when the band's coming back together and dates and venues.
Okay.
You'll be the first to know.
Okay, and... Now, a quick word from our sponsors.
The DG Leisure Center arrives at Harding and Hobbs and smashes the price barrier. With the five-function Sinclair Cambridge percentage calculator, now only $7.95, including, yes, including that. The 13-function Cambridge Scientific with logarithmic keys for only $12.95, including that. See all the superb Sinclair range at the DG Leisure Center at Harding and Hobbs, Clapham Junction, Southwest 11.
Paperwork. Oh, those dollars go. Worse every year. Figuring percentages really gets me.
It's the budgets. You know, I chew up more pencils.
Markups, discounts, too much, too much.
There's gotta be an answer.
Introducing the answer. A really small calculator. A really silent electronic. A really fast thinker. One that works anywhere on battery or plug-in. One with all the calculator know-how you'll probably ever need. Introducing the world's smallest electronic calculator from the maker of the world's most complete line, Sharp. Introducing the LC8, world's smallest electronic calculator by Sharp. Price tag to match, $345 complete. LC8, the answer. See it.
And we're back. Okay, so now it's time for the host's retro computing gift idea. Well, this one's not retro per se, but everyone is sort of aware of the different game and computer emulator systems that are using a Raspberry Pi as the core hardware. And quite a lot of us have had different applications and servers running on various flavors of the Pi for our machines. Well, here's a new flavor for the Pi. It's the Orange Pi. Now, as the Pi is actually built on an open source hardware platform, here is the Orange Pi, links included. So for a mere $39 US, you get one serious piece of computing hardware. So it uses the same 40-pin header that's available on the Raspberry Pi. You know, you got your USB interfaces, you know, card slot. This one actually has the Wi-Fi module built in. It's quite a lot more serious processor, but it's quite a bundle of computing power. As I said, $39. So if you're looking for a alternative platform to do some Pi programming on, have a look at this one. I actually think it's quite good. Not quite down to the Raspberry Pi Zero for $5, but I think $39 is quite an affordable price for this package. So guys, were you ever aware that you could get your Pi in other flavors?
That sounds dirty.
I had heard of the this one before, but only just sort of like tangentially. I think, you know, I knew that there were some. I thought they were straight clones of the Raspberry Pi, but this is actually a much enhanced one, right? I mean, it's faster.
Yeah.
It seems to have things like Wi-Fi on it already, and so that's pretty cool. Because it's slightly more expensive than an actual Raspberry Pi, but I could see this being kind of useful for running a media center or something like that, where, you know, it might actually be handy to have something a little bit more powerful.
Yeah, there's another one out there, I believe, called the Banana Pi. I don't know if it's actually shipping yet. Should check their website later on. But so there's all different bits and pieces that you can get out there for Pi. So throw it all together, and I suppose you've got a bit of a fruit salad of different fruit pies.
No, I think you end up with pie caken.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so let's just pop over and see what's happening in the wonderful world of eBay. So, Jack, I'll let you start us away on our eBay finds.
Well, I've got something that I came across that I have never used, but I remember seeing this. It's called the Incredible Musical Keyboard for the Commodore 64. This is basically a thing that you would slip over the top of your Commodore 64, and it would like most of the keys would just be visible, but like the upper part of the space where, like, it covers up the upper part of your keyboard with what looked like musical keyboard keys. So if you have the software that's enabled to interpret presses on the upper number keys or letter keys, whichever they are, as in the right way, then you can play it like a piano, sort of. And I remember this from back in the day, and it looked kind of cool. It has a fairly outrageous price, I think. $79 they want as the buy it now price. There's not bidding on it right now. So it does seem to include maybe some software. I think it does.
There's a very small line in the, it says here, great condition, includes the box, manuals, floppy, and songbooks.
Yeah. So there's the floppy is there. So could be a fun item. I think the price is too high, sadly. But if somebody wants this, why not? And I mean, there are people who use Commodore 64s as sort of a dedicated musical device playing the SID chip. And if you're writing your own software and want to be able to actually use it in this way with this sort of musical keyboard rather than hitting the keys straight as they are, this could be a way to do, it could be an interesting thing to add to your system.
Cool.
So,
and it comes with songbooks.
Yeah.
World's easiest songs. And super songs with easy melodies.
Perfect. That's what I need.
Yeah, something a band could use.
We could have used this, Paul.
And indeed.
Okay. Well, there was a little bit of a thread of calculators going through today's show, not quite as much as in the hardware mods, but I thought I'd go for a look through eBay to see if I could find anything interesting as far as a calculator goes. So I've found this one. It's an antique metal calculator. So they call it antique interest time computer, 1917 mechanical calculator by Sterling Manufacturing in Minneapolis. Now, this is definitely doesn't require batteries, and it's definitely not something I want to drop off the table and land on my feet. So I think this one weighs in, I think I saw it here, yep, 10 pounds, 7 ounces. And it's about 9 inches in length, and yeah, so still trying to figure out exactly how it's used, but
I was trying to figure that out myself. It seems
instead of just as a weapon in a game of Cluedo.
Yeah, it seems like it has at least 3 rotating cylinders, but possibly more. There seems like there's a on each side. I think there's a big wheel that you can turn internal cylinders, and I suspect that these buttons that you can see there probably sort of indicate let you select which cylinder you're turning.
Mm.
But
yeah. I had a quick search for information about this and to find out exactly what it was calculating. I'm having a guess that it's interest over time, but
So indeed an interesting eBay find.
Mm. So, yeah, and currently only has 2 bids on it for $10.49, and I hate to think what the shipping's going to be down here to Australia.
About $1 per pound? Is that what we're talking about here?
Okay, so now for the not-so-brief section of the eBay segment. Paul, what have you found this time to entertain and educate us?
Okay, I found a few things. I think probably the star of the ones that I have found is this set. It's a Texas Instruments CC40 set. And so there are all kinds of things that are kind of goofy about this auction, not least of which this seems to be the eBay user's first auction. And the picture, the sort of like headline picture, is this weird, completely front-on view of a bunch of flat things on a table, and then, you know, like 80% of the photo above it is just like blank space. So it's a very weird, look at it. But what it actually is a TI CC40 pretty much full system. So it's got the printer, it's got the, actually it looks like it has 2 printers, a printer and a printer plotter. It has an RS-232 unit and a modem unit. It has the manuals, and in fact actually has a little card on it that says, from the desk of Cecil Green, who was allegedly, quite possibly truly, one of the founders of Texas Instruments. So this was apparently given to whoever's collection this has come from, sort of directly from the source. But it's beautiful. It actually has a lot of, it has more pieces than I've ever seen, of this system together. The CC40, if I'm not mistaken, one of the big problems with this is, it's the Compact Computer 40 is what it stands for. And one of the big problems with this is that it actually has no storage. I'm not sure if any like solution has been found for this. It has, so it has RS-232 out. You can get data in and out serially, but I don't think it has a cassette. Some sort of floppy storage that, or maybe it might have been some kind of tape storage that was announced but never actually delivered. So it's a weird computer. I kind of want one, but yet, it's kind of hard to know how you would use it. But this is definitely the nicest setup I've seen. When I originally put it in here, it was running at a bid of $1. And it has already reached 125 about. So it's I suspect it's going to go for a lot, but Anyway, it's a neat thing to see, at least. Have any of you heard of or used or know anything about the CC-40?
Apart from it that it existed, no. But that's definitely a great way of getting a fairly complete set into your collection. And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, if there is some way of getting some offline some storage connected to it. But still, to have the printer and the plotter and all the other connections there, that's still quite a good complete set. You know.
So I've never heard of this thing at all. Did it connect to an external screen at all, or is it just kind of LCD display on the device?
Just a little LCD display that's on the device.
Cool.
Yeah, so it does have internal storage, and I think the batteries will keep that alive for a long time. But the problem is that you know, at some point the batteries will fail, and then you will lose whatever you had. So this was actually one of the original place that the hex bus was implemented, and the hex bus is sort of like a prototype USB. So it's all these things are sort of hot swappable. So anyway, I thought that was pretty cool to see. So I think it's probably going to get out of my own range for getting it, but it's neat to see all these things together in a package that presumably was about as complete as it could be, since it was provided by the actual founder of TI. But so the other couple things that I wanted to mention were a couple of auctions for 3D printed things. So I don't know if we've mentioned this one before, but there's an auction for a Gear for Macintosh 512K vintage floppy drive eject Mac Sony Apple. What it is basically is a 3D printed Gear that can replace ones where the teeth have been broken off. So it's fairly common for these 3.5-inch drives. You know, these are the same ones I think used in the Apple IIgs, 2C Plus, early Macs, Lisa 2, where basically they freeze up, you know, after time. They sort of get gummed up and can't, the mechanism can't move. But if you try to make them eject, then the motor will try its best to make the eject happen. And since it eventually, since it can't, it will eventually just break the teeth on the gear. So I think this is a fairly common piece to need to replace. And this is it's $849, buy it now for one piece, free shipping. I think it's kind of a neat thing to know about. And the other one is a 3D printed case for the SuperCard Pro, which is it's a USB, I think it's a USB connected card that will run a vintage era disk drive, you know, so you can use this to connect to like a 5.5-inch or 5.25-inch drive and read the data off of it. It's kind of comparable to the CryoFlux and to the Disk Ferret in that it can read sort of like flux level images. And the advantage of it is that it's sort of current and maintained. I think we can probably stop with those three.
Yeah, my only thought on the gear is that I'd want to know a bit more about the plastic, the media that's been used to do it, because my understanding is that's always been the issue, is how long will the replacement 3D printed gear actually last. Now, yes, it's going to probably work better than in the example of the eBay auction here, where the plastic has gone brittle. And then when the systems forced it to eject, that the teeth basically just fracture and fall off. But if the parts can be made from a plastic that is going to take the, I won't say the daily use, but at least it's going to stand up to it, that's great. Even $849 free postage. I don't really consider that a an overly high price compared to getting my own 3D printer or hunting down. They say that you can't get this part from any of the other suppliers. Now, I've looked at quite a few websites for replacement gears, and this one's definitely going to get bookmarked. You know, don't need one at the moment, but
yeah, it is tempting to get spares.
Yeah, it is tempting to get a spare just in case, because I've got some very early, well, exact 512K Mac, a set of the internal drive and a couple of external drives. So, you know, maybe it's worth getting one just to have it there in my box of spares, as long as I don't lose it. Anyway,
it does say that they're made from strong ultra-detail plastic, so I don't know what that means, you know, but at least a little bit of thought went into it, at least. Though if it breaks, you know, you can always just get another one.
Yeah, might check out Retro Connector and see what Charles has got to say. Okay, so, gentlemen, closing discussions. Do we have anything that we want to add in? I believe Ken's got... Yeah, you got a special something?
I do have a little something. So, a very generous Juice GS subscriber has offered to sponsor an RCR podcast listener for a subscription to Juice GS for the calendar year 2016. Yay!
Nice.
Ooh.
So we have decided to award this randomly. There will not be a contest, but we do need to figure out who is listening and who is participating and who is interested in winning. And so what we are going to do is on Twitter, where we are RCR Podcast, we would like anyone who is interested in entering this competition, this contest, this drawing, to retweet our tweet promoting this episode, episode number 117 of the Retro Computing Roundtable. When the show airs, there will be a tweet with a link to this episode that mentions Juice GS. And if you retweet that, then you'll be entered into a random drawing to win a subscription to Juice GS for calendar year 2016. Now, that tweet must be retweeted by noon Eastern Standard Time on Sunday, January 17th. That is the cutoff date. We will download a list of the retweeters on that date and time, and if you are among that list, you will be entered into the drawing. Also, your public, your tweets must be public. They can't be private or locked, because we need to be able to see who you are and that you tweeted it. If you want to retweet it anyway, that's great. And, you know, I mean, you don't need to want to win Juice GS to retweet our links, but you will be considered for this contest if you do. So thanks so much for listening.
Nice.
Okay. I think it's most generous of one of your subscribers to offer that up to the RCR for a competition prize. So thank you very much.
I forgot to ask him whether or not he wished to remain anonymous, so at this time I'm going to err on the side of caution. I'll check with him in time for the next episode, and when we announce the winner, if I can give credit where it's due, I will do so.
Okay, well, I had one thought. I was just recently putting a solid-state storage device into my Apple IIc. Unisdisk Air. So basically it's a Wi-Fi connected SD card acting as to serve disk images to my Apple IIc. So it's quite a nice little device. So I really love it. But as I was closing up the computer, it dawned on me that this Apple IIc that I bought back in 1984 when I used to work for a computer dealer, and this was 1984 was when the 2C was released, along with that other Mackin thingy, I think that came out in 84 as well. And I realized I'd never actually opened this computer up before. Now, as I said earlier in the podcast, I've worked on so many different machines, so building them up from parts or upgrading bits and pieces, and you know, quite an extensive range of machines, not just your modern Windows and Linux machines and the occasional Mac. But I just thought, so there was a machine which I have used extensively, but never actually opened it up. So I took I took some photos while I was doing the upgrade. And I kind of thinking, well, maybe I should open up again and just take some more photos, because, you know, as I said, I'd never seen the inside of this machine, and it's, 32 years old.
must have been quite dusty in there.
Actually, it was. I'm surprised it was. Yeah, so it got a little bit of a brush out. You know, this is the first computer that I ever bought. Not the first one I used, but the first one which I parted with my own money to have. And it would be I should say that up till then, the only computer I've ever owned that I've never opened up, and you know, I've owned iMacs. I've opened them up to upgrade drives and bits and pieces inside them. I've built so many Linux and Windows machines from putting the bits together. I just thought it was so strange that I had a machine in my house for so long and never had taken a screwdriver to it. So just me musing there. So, gents, anything else happening? I think Jack and Paul have already given us quite an interesting insight to their college band, but... I think we'll still include the link to that, or you'll have to sort of edit out all that audio there, Paul.
I think mostly it can stand.
Okay. Well, I think that's it for this show. You can find all our show notes at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the Vintage Computer forums. And of course, you can follow RCR on Twitter, and if you retweet our episode 117 announcement, you'll go into the draw for a Juice GS subscription.
Yay!
You can join our Facebook group, that's under facebook.com/groups/RCR podcast. And of course, there's good old-fashioned email feedback, so at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're also a member of the Throwback Network. And if you pop over, you'll be able to find other similarly veined retro podcasts of various machines and things. And of course, help others find our podcast by writing a review on iTunes. So, gentlemen, until next time,
Retro Computes!
Is our sponsor Escape Dog?
that took a turn I wasn't quite anticipating, but anyway.
Thank you for humoring me. It was amazing.
Just wait till you hear it.
Yes. Oh, yeah.